Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Tuesday, September 29th, 2015, on Capitol Hill. Planned Parenthood fights back against lies and deception.
Lies and deception.
The orchestrated effort to take down Planned Parenthood has reached a peak moment. Over the summer, we have seen these carefully edited, selectively edited gotcha videos that were pushed out in the same manner that James O'Keefe used phony videos to take down the community organizing group Acorn a few years back. And this time, Planned Parenthood is better equipped to fight back, and it's fair to say that some Democrats are not simply lying down and allowing this to happen. And at this point, as we trend toward a possible government shutdown, as the budget expires tomorrow, it appears that Planned Parenthood will dodge most of the efforts to defund federal payments. Part of the reason is that it's a real complicated picture. The money, the roughly $500 million each year in federal funds that flow to Planned Parenthood, largely come from Medicaid reimbursements. And so it's not simply flipping a switch or writing a bill that says no more money for Planned Parenthood. Now, the other obvious problem here is that the whole basis for this is entirely political and contrived. And to her credit, Cecile Richards, the CEO of Planned Parenthood, appeared on Capitol Hill before some very offensive members of Congress who weren't interested in the truth. They were just grandstanding to continue and expand the smear campaign against Planned Parenthood. And Richard said, "This campaign is based on efforts by our opponents to entrap our doctors and clinicians into breaking the law. And once again, our opponents failed." Now, this funding fight is nominally about abortion and fetal tissue. But Republicans see that their voters hate Planned Parenthood. And this is red meat, catnip, kryptonite, whatever you want to call it. And it's fair to say that Planned Parenthood has been politically active. They've got a campaign, a separate campaign operation, a PAC. And they do mostly support Democrats. But that's not some kind of a conspiracy. It's shared interests. So we had Republican Congressman Jim Jordan grandstanding about the barbaric and repulsive videos. And they have widened their effort by saying, well, let's give the money that Planned Parenthood gets to other acceptable to the right wing, women's health organizations. And we know that this is all just about abortion. And you're tired of hearing that only 3% of Planned Parenthood's funds go toward abortion. It's all carefully separated. No federal money is used to support abortions. But these facts don't matter because it is a political smear. And I heard Sean Hannity on his radio show advancing some of these talking points yesterday where he said, yeah, you know, let's shift the money to another group so that we're still fully funding the federal government, but we can tell our voters that we cut off funding to Planned Parenthood. Meanwhile, in Missouri, an investigation into Planned Parenthood has flatly cleared it of any wrongdoing in the handling of fetal tissue. The office of the Missouri Attorney General has found no evidence that Planned Parenthood of St. Louis has engaged in unlawful disposal of fetal organs and tissue. So most of this is trumped up. Now, there's no question that these videos captured some Planned Parenthood officials saying some things that make you cringe. But the idea advanced by Carly Fiorina that there are videos of live fetuses on a table as people discuss harvesting their brain or other tissues, that shows how far this hysteria has gone. And the people like Carly Fiorina are willing to say anything, even if it's completely divorced from the truth, because it will score political points. Now, last week when Pope Francis was in Washington, he used some carefully calibrated words to talk about the sanctity of life. But he never mentioned contraception or abortion specifically. He did explicitly talk about the death penalty, and that his idea of valuing human life does not include capital punishment. Yesterday, I reported to you that Georgia and Oklahoma and Virginia are all eager to execute a fresh round of convicts. They're trading the fatal drugs in order to achieve that. And the Pope himself got involved in this case in Georgia where the first woman in 70 years is scheduled to be executed tonight. And Pope Francis wrote a letter delivered to the Georgia Parole Board saying, while not wishing to minimize the gravity of the crime for which Ms. Gissen Dander has been convicted, and while sympathizing with the victims, I nonetheless implore you, in consideration of the reasons that have been expressed to your board, to commute the sentence to one that would better express both justice and mercy. Now, Kelly Gissen Dander was convicted of the death of her husband, but she was conspiring with her boyfriend, who actually killed her husband. The boyfriend has a life sentence, but is not being executed. And she has been ordered executed. So what's interesting is yesterday afternoon, the Georgia State Board of Pardons and Paroles granted an 11th hour clemency hearing. And it's supposed to be held sometime today. I don't have an exact schedule noted in this article. But by 7 p.m. tonight, this 47-year-old mother of three may be the first woman killed by the state in 70 years, or she may receive a clemency act, which would probably convert her sentence to life without parole. In Yemen, while Saudi Arabia strenuously denies it's responsible, the death toll from the airstrike that hit a wedding party has jumped from in the 20s to 131 people. But the Saudi coalition says there had been no air operations in the area for 3 days, and the reports about this incident are totally false news. Well, tell that to 131 dead people. And the death toll of civilians in the carnage in Yemen, which has been treated as an American shooting gallery for many years until Saudi Arabia widened the fray earlier this year, 2,300. Every day, I like to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. We name names: Anna Gordonier, Mona Kobus, Kevin Beckley, Keith Hull. They're all monthly subscribers, and I thank each and every one of you. And this is where I make the gentle suggestion that if you're not a subscriber, you ought to become one. So come on over to the new, freshly redesigned PeterBCollins.com website. Click on the menu button in the upper right, and then start a subscription, or whatever it says. I don't have it in front of me. And when you click on that, you go to a page where you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or $50 annual subscription. You can make a one-time contribution by PayPal of any amount. There's a P.O. box there if you're allergic to PayPal and you prefer to operate by check, money order, or cash. There are many ways you can support my work. You can buy the new app for iPhones and iPads. It's in the App Store at Apple. $2.99. However you do it, I'm grateful for your support, and I thank you for grabbing my podcasts as often as you do. Well, let's take a look at yesterday's events at the United Nations. And if we used a tennis metaphor, I would say it's advantage Putin, because he came off as a pretty sturdy and wily, knowledgeable world leader, where Obama was reduced to finger-pointing and name-calling and veiled threats. We'll get to some of those in a moment. But the hypocrisy of the representations by President Obama, ignoring the U.S. role in the coup in Ukraine, ignoring the U.S. role in trying to take out the Assad government by supporting all of the rebels there, including the Islamic State at one point, wasn't called that. And so it's really hard to look at this and not see that the U.S. bases many of its political arguments and policies on wishful thinking, fantasies, or false narratives. And yesterday, Putin seemed to be the realist, the guy who had aces in his pocket, the new Russian base in Syria, the intelligence sharing agreement that Russia announced to the surprise of the United States and all of our spy agencies. That includes Syria, because, of course, Putin frames this as defending the state of Syria against terrorists. That's the kind of language the U.S. uses in Afghanistan, in Libya, in so many countries where we are active with covert ops and drone strikes. And, as we'll get to in a moment, the U.S. position about Ukraine is laughable. Because most of the world knows, and Putin, as I said, told Charlie Rose point blank on 60 Minutes Sunday night, that there was an orchestrated effort to overthrow the Yanukovych government. And the U.S. was knee-deep in it. And Obama said, oh, you know, we don't really have that many economic interests in Ukraine. Well, that doesn't square with the way we operate. And as Obama talks about some managed transition in Syria in which the Assad government would gradually be eased out of power, well, who decides who replaces Assad? We haven't done a very good job in Afghanistan or Iraq, and Libya is just a wide open, out of control, unstructured nation right now. And building on those experiences, we say that, you know, we want a transition. We want Assad gone. Well, that policy hasn't worked for 3.5 years. And I don't know if you saw the photo op that was staged between Obama and Putin, but it was the chilliest thing I've ever seen between two leaders of state. They marched out into the zone where the cameras were pointed. They looked at each other, said absolutely nothing, had really grim looks on their faces. They shook hands for just as long as they could stand it, and then exited very quickly. It was about 15 seconds from start to finish. Now, I'd like you to listen to some commentary from Simon Jenkins, published in The Guardian today. Putin is right. Everyone knows Putin is right, and the only way forward in Syria, if not to eternal slaughter, is via the established government of Assad and his Lebanese and Iranian allies. That is the real politic. That's what pragmatism dictates. In the West, foreign policy has long been a branch of domestic politics with added sermonizing. What to do in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, even Ukraine, has been dictated not by what might work, but what looks good. The megaphone is mightier than the brain. The result of American and British grandstanding at the UN this week, seeing who can be ruder about Assad, is that Putin has gathered ever more cards to his pack. Putin has already performed the two primary duties of a Russian leader, bringing stability and pride. He now faces turbulent Russian minorities across his European frontier and a serious menace from Muslim states to his south. He is perforce becoming a player on a wider stage. He has read Iran, India, and Syria correctly. He is no fool. And later, Simon Jenkins says, Russia has accepted that the forcible toppling of Assad, which Britain has predicted since 2011, is not a realistic path to peace. If he is to go, it will be after his enemies have been driven back and not before. And Jenkins closes with this, the true nature of the West's commitment to Syria, in Syria, was revealed in Obama's remark to the UN that because alternatives are surely worse, is no reason to support tyrants. In other words, American feel-good is more important than Syrian lives. That's worth thinking about. Now we have an allegation from France, the foreign minister, saying that the Russian claims to be fighting against the Islamic State in Syria are merely for show, and that there haven't been any meaningful military operations to date. Now, France is bragging about how on Sunday they joined the shooting gallery in Syria with airstrikes against the Islamic State. And so from France, it's neener, neener, neener. One thing that did leak out of the Monday night meeting between Obama and Putin that ran 90 minutes and was divided, we're told, between topics Syria and Ukraine, is that Putin agreed not to put Russian ground troops into Syria. Joe Lauria has covered the United Nations as an independent reporter for a long time, and he's contributed to our show on many occasions. He wrote a piece that's published, and I've linked to it in the show file for this podcast, at consortiumnews.com, entitled Obama's Self-Deceit. And he writes, there was stunned silence in the General Assembly Hall Monday as Obama warned leaders against falling back to pre-UN days in which strong nations impose their will by force against the weak. The silence in the chamber came because everything Obama ascribed to others perfectly describes U.S. behavior from the end of World War II until today. And Joe Lauria recaps some of that history and says, on Monday, Obama was blaming Russia and China for the mess that Washington has created, saying, we see some major powers assert themselves in ways that contravene international law. And Obama cited Russia's annexation of Crimea and further aggression in eastern Ukraine. But he didn't mention the documented U.S. orchestrated coup against a democratically elected president in Kiev, which eastern Ukrainians have resisted. Russia has helped them, but the U.S., with all its fancy surveillance, has yet to come up with a scrap of evidence of a Russian invasion of Ukraine. And Lauria says, at heart is either Obama's willful ignorance of Ukraine, a clumsy attempt at disinformation, or, as Putin suggested, a big measure of self-deception. Obama said Ukrainians favor the West. That may be true of most Western Ukrainians, but not the whole country. Then he said the U.S. has few economic interests in Ukraine. And Lauria notes that's woefully ignorant or a blatant lie. Monsanto has a big interest. Joe Biden's son Hunter and a John Kerry family friend have joined the board of Burisma Holdings, Ukraine's largest private gas producer. And then he goes on to note that in Syria, Obama and his junior partners in Europe insist that Assad must leave office, as though that would make ISIS lay down its arms. Yeah. And of course, if you force Assad out, you then have the Islamic State claiming that they are the rightful leaders of Syria. Lauria says Obama's position presupposes that the war would end as soon as a new Syrian leader calls off the fight. So I encourage you to read that piece, as well as a longer analysis written by the editor and publisher at consortiumnews.com, Robert Perry. His piece is called The Power of False Narrative. And I have scheduled an interview, an in-depth interview with Bob Perry for later today, so I'm going to save the analysis of his piece for that conversation, and we'll bring you an excerpt of it tomorrow, if all goes as planned. The new leader of Volkswagen has announced plans to refit, after recalling, as many as 11 million vehicles worldwide, after the disclosure that it had a software piece that faked emissions tests. This could cost Volkswagen as much as $6.5 billion, but I think it's the only way out if they hope to reclaim any credibility. As you probably know, Kevin McCarthy of Southern California, he's from Bakersfield, is the number two Republican in the House, and he has announced he wants to be the Speaker. But just do a Google search, or use Bing if you like, and enter Kevin McCarthy and affair. And results will come up in the thousands. That Kevin McCarthy has been conducting an affair with another member of Congress, a woman from North Carolina named Renee Elmers, I know nothing about this. I haven't observed them, wearing baseball caps and sneaking around. But if a simple Google search reveals thousands of listings of an alleged affair between the Republican leader and another member of Congress, how can the Family Values Republicans even consider naming him Speaker? I mean, remember when Gingrich stepped down and they brought out a guy who was Speaker for 3 days, Bob Livingston of, Louisiana? And then he tearfully said, yeah, I've been shtupping the babe and I gotta go. Then they put Dennis Hastert in there, who we now know was fooling around with boys when he was the wrestling coach at a high school in suburban Chicago. And so it's beyond me how these Republicans, who talk so much about their family values and, pander to the religious extremists in this country, could consider naming Kevin McCarthy as their leader. We'll see how that one plays out. Trevor Noah made his debut last night in the chair that Jon Stewart occupied on The Daily Show set for 16 years or so. And I give him credit. I wouldn't want to do that. Who wants to follow Jon Stewart? And Trevor Noah is little known in the United States. He's a comic from South Africa. He's got some weird accents that take a little getting used to. And he really didn't change the format. It was two segments of satire followed by an interview. A Daily Show correspondent appeared in one segment. So the, central elements of the show remain the same, and it remains to be seen if Trevor Noah can draw an audience with his own individual personality. We shall see. And finally today, we have a dispute here in San Francisco about bicycles and whether you need to make a complete stop at a stop sign or a traffic light at every intersection. And a group of bicycle advocates got several members of the Board of Supervisors to sponsor a bill permitting reduced enforcement and essentially acknowledging the Idaho stop. Now, you are probably familiar with the California stop, which is where you don't come to a complete stop in your automobile and roll through a stop sign or make a turn on a stop sign without a complete stop. Well, the Idaho stop is related, I think, just to bicycles. And it makes a lot of sense. If you ride a bike, you know what it takes to come to a complete stop. And if you've got a bike with a lot of gears, to start back up again and get up to speed can be time-consuming, tiring, and annoying. And if there is no traffic there in the form of pedestrians, vehicles, or other bicycles, then why should we stand on the letter of the law? But that's what Mayor Ed Lee, who is coasting to re-election in November with only one token opponent, he said, no, we can't confuse people. The law is the law. And he is going to veto the measure, despite the fact that six supervisors approved it. And to me, this is just a matter of common sense. Here in California, if you get caught rolling through a stop sign or a traffic signal, it's a moving violation that goes onto your driver's license record. I don't think that should be. And secondly, I think enforcement should not be zero tolerance. I think the law should only be enforced when an accident occurs, when someone has failed to use the appropriate judgment and discretion, and something goes wrong. But Ed Lee's got a stick up his butt. And the Idaho stop will not be permitted in San Francisco, although we can hope that some cops simply refuse to enforce the letter of the law, which I think is common sense. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the free podcast that you're welcome to share almost anywhere. Put it up on Facebook. Click that like button and share it, will you? I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you. Until we meet again, happy trails to you. Keep smiling.